That can come into the exchange and buy defined contribution plans. So they are not using risk adjustment for that program. Now, Utah has a very original, different kind of approach to what they are doing with risk adjustment. They have established a risk adjuster board for the exchange, and that risk adjuster board consists of carriers that are in that market. So it is managed by the insurers in that market. And what happens is that enrollees complete a health assessment at the time that they enroll. And this assessment is used by insurers, and they compare the premium that those individuals pay when they enroll to what their to what their premium would be if they were allowed to rate based on the information that they get through that health assessment. And through the comparison of those different premiums, they transfer payments back and forth between the insurers to adjust for the differential risk selection that may occur between the different carriers. So they use they're not using claims-based data, but they are using a health assessment to do that. Excuse me. I'll go to the next slide. So some risk adjustment options that the state has. Before we talk about some of the options that are available for risk adjustment, I just wanted to mention a few things. First, this is one of the things where HHS has yet to actively consult with the states. They're supposed to be working with the states on risk adjustment, so they have yet to work on this. However, they are supposed to be working with the NAIC on risk adjustment models, and I'm going to stress this fact that it's supposed to be models, not model. So there's a variety of different ways that states can do risk adjustment. So in consultation, there may not be one national approach, but there's the ability for a variety of models to be used for the states. But again, this process with the NAIC also has yet to start. Thirdly, states are in very different places regarding the availability of data and the methods expertise that exists within the state. One area where Minnesota is actually probably ahead of the game for most other states is we have many risk adjustment experts that exist within this state. Actually, I was talking this last week and the week before with Dave Knutson, who is one of those experts in the state. He's actually out of the country today. He wished he could have been here today to help with this discussion, but many of the comments that I have throughout the rest of this presentation are based on some conversations and some initial modeling and at work that he has done with some other national colleagues on this particular issue. One other thing to point out is around data availability. Something that HHS is likely to consider in thinking about what types of models are available for risk adjustment is what types of data states will have available to do this. There are some states that have all-payer claims databases that could help them do this. Other states do not have this type of data at all, and it could be costly and time-consuming for them to set up these types of databases to have ready to go in 2014. And so, as you'll see on the next page, there may be a variety of different mechanisms that HHS would consider in terms of methods and data availability to use for risk adjustment. And then lastly, another thing just to keep in mind is that risk adjustment will help to mitigate but will not eliminate adverse selection. So there's still consideration needed on the mechanisms to address adverse selection inside and outside the exchange that we discussed at the last meeting. So something to keep in mind is that this will not eliminate all of it. One thing actually that I wanted to mention prior to the slide that Mr. Knutson wanted me to mention is that he and national colleagues are working on a variety of modeling techniques using data to figure out how accurate a risk adjustment mechanism could be in predicting the risks of people inside and outside the exchange in those pools. There's some preliminary results of that, but it's not yet ready to be shared, but I'll share some of the initial results from that in some of the later slides that are coming up. So regarding risk adjustment methods, there are generally two methods that you could be using for risk adjustment. The first is referred to as prospective, and what that means is that you use historical-based data to determine risk adjustment payments that will be used in a subsequent period. Generally, but not always, this can be done in an individual level. So what that means is you use an individual's past history or past health status to determine what their risk adjustment payments would be going forward as an individual to individual-based plans. Regarding prospective risk adjustment, one of the pros to consider regarding this method is that it's an accurate assessment of predictable risk, but maybe less accurate at predicting unpredictable risk, and that's something that more of a concurrent method is better at doing. It is more resistant to gaming and upcoding because the payments are determined up front rather than at the back end, which we'll describe on concurrent risk adjustment. And there's a greater incentive to manage care for higher risk individuals, particularly when the risk adjustment payment is based on an individual basis, where individuals, the payment is based on their past history, and the plans get one upfront payment, and it's not reconciled at the end for what experience they actually had. So the plans have the incentive to take that payment and manage the care in the best way that they can for those individuals. Another method for risk adjustment is what's deemed concurrent risk adjustment, and this is the use of current health-based data for current risk-adjusted payments. Generally, this requires a retrospective review of the payment, so you do payment reconciliation at the back end. And this is generally done at an aggregate insurer level instead of an individual level, but not always. So again, some pros and cons of this is a more accurate assessment of predictable and unpredictable risk than under the prospective method. It's less resistant to gaming and upcoding. Less incentive to effectively manage care for higher risk individuals, but it's better than a typical reinsurance mechanism. And the reason for this is that it's done on the back end, and so insurers may have some incentive to put more risks in there during the year to get paid at the back end. And it may be simpler to administer if it's done at an aggregate versus an individual level, just because of the data availability and the analysis that would need to be done. Some options around data. There's a variety of different data sources that can be used to do risk adjustment. I'm going to mention four of them here in broad categories. And again, these are broad categories, and there may be some others that fit in between here. But to make this a more simple, understandable discussion, they're broken out into four categories. The first of which is diagnosis-based claims data. And this is the most accurate data source to use to determine what the risk of individuals would be. But the con here is that it would exclude the uninsured and some new to the state, so it wouldn't include some of those people. For states that don't have an all-payer claims database, there would be some substantial cost and time associated with getting this up and running, so it's one of the things that HHS would likely consider in the models that they would establish for what data could be used for risk adjustment. Insurer diagnosis reporting. Essentially what this means is it would not be based on claims data, but based on reporting by insurers in some type of mechanism through surveys or forms or that type of thing. Again, this is another accurate source of data, but it would exclude the uninsured and those new to the state, and generally would require auditing on the back end to ensure that the information that was coming in was accurate. This could be less costly for states to implement that don't have a claims database, but there would be costs associated with auditing. A third mechanism is an enrollee health status questionnaire. As I was mentioning earlier, this is what Utah currently uses for their risk adjustment mechanism. This is generally less accurate because it's based on self-reporting of individuals, so they might not be truthful in what they're reporting their risks, but it's more inclusive of the population, so you'd get the new enrollees, the new uninsured, those new to the state, you'd have that information. It would also likely be lower cost to administer and easier to use. And lastly, there's another option for data, and that's just demographic data only, so not using health status-based information, but using demographics as well. This is a less accurate way of determining risk, but again, maybe more inclusive of the population and would be lower cost and easier to administer as well. The last risk adjustment option to consider is who would do the risk adjustment. There are a couple of different ways to do this, and I've just listed some two very basic ways of doing this. There are likely some in-betweens here as well in terms of options. But one is you could affiliate the risk adjustment mechanism with the exchange. Some pros of this is that it would ease the administration and would be lower cost for those that are participating in the exchange. For example, the information that's already being collected by the exchange would already be available, so it would be easier for them to administer. And the collection of transfer of funds would also already be done in the exchange, so it would be a potentially easier way to exchange funds between insurers. A con of this is that you would have to have a separate mechanism for those that are outside the exchange, given that risk adjustment is supposed to apply inside and outside the exchange. And so you'd have to have a separate mechanism to collect information and to transfer funds. Lastly, one of the pros to consider related to affiliating risk adjustment with the exchange is that you could potentially use federal startup money that will be available for the exchange to establish the risk adjustment functions. So that's something to consider as well. If you do it as a separate entity, one of the pros here is that you could have a single streamlined mechanism for the collection and analysis of the data that you would need and the transfer of funds. You'd one way of doing it instead of under the exchange. You'd have to have two different ways of doing it. And lastly, the financing mechanism is a little unclear. Not clear at this point whether or not you could use exchange startup money to do this if it was through a separate entity, because it wouldn't be related to the exchange operations. So those are the basics and background of risk adjustment and the options pertaining to those things. Lastly, what we're going to talk about in this presentation was one of the other risk-sharing mechanisms that's given as an option in the exchange for states. The federal health reform law gives states the option of merging their individual and small group markets. Today, we do not have information, actuarial information, to provide you on the pros and cons as to what that impact would be, but we're going to be providing you some policy analysis of what the pros and cons could be of merging those two markets. So some things to consider before we talk about the pros and cons of merging those markets. In 2014, the market will change substantially. The first thing to keep in mind is that benefit and rating rules for both markets are going to be the same. So one thing to keep in mind. Secondly, the definition of small group is going to include groups of one or the self-employed. So these individuals are essentially going to be able to pick which market they really want to go into to get coverage. Third, you will have new and quite sizable populations that will be added to the individual market. For example, a large share of the uninsured, MSHA enrollees, and those potentially eligible, potentially Minnesota Care individuals. Lastly, another thing to keep in mind is that the federal health reform law increases wellness discounts allowed under group plans from 20% to 30%, and HHS is given the flexibility to increase it to 50%. And there's an option there for a demonstration program where 10 states would be allowed to participate in a wellness demonstration program to extend those discounts to the individual market as well. So there's the option here for states to do wellness discounts for both of these markets for some states. So next, Manny and I are going to split here the pros and cons for considering market merger. I'm going to do the pros, and Manny is going to expertly do the cons. So the first pro of considering market merger is that it would address the risk of adverse selection by self-employed people between the two markets. So as we were saying, groups of one are going to be able to choose which market they go into. So there may be an incentive based on the health status of that person that whatever risk pool is a little healthier and has the better premiums, that's the one that they may choose to go into. So that's a pro there, is that it would reduce that adverse selection. Secondly, by putting the two pools together, it creates a larger and more stable risk pool for premium variation that you would see between the two markets. Third, based on this larger risk pool, you may encourage new insurers to enter the market. So if you have a larger risk pool and insurers can pool that to establish their pricing or have more stable pricing, they may be more encouraged to enter that market. Fourth, it may encourage small groups to participate in the exchange. And I'll explain this a little bit more in terms of what this means. Under the exchange, where employees are going to be able to essentially buy individual-based products or choose the plan that they want, you likely will have small group plans outside the exchange that won't exactly be able to look like small group plans inside the exchange, because there's a different choice by employees there. But if you merge the two markets, the pricing between those will be similar, and so it may encourage those small groups or those employees to actually want to be in the exchange, because the risk base will be similar. Also on here, it could simplify the consumer experience to have the markets merged and encourage portability. So consumers would be able to move from the small group and the individual market and keep their same plan at the same premium. So they wouldn't, if the markets were different, they could be assessed a different, if they were in the same plan, could be assessed a different premium, because the risk pools would be different and would establish different premiums based on those risk pools. It would also simplify the administration and cost of the exchange. So you likely wouldn't need to have as many functionalities or have as many things for the exchange to do that would be different between the small group and individual market. They could be more similar. So you could ease some administration. Lastly, based on this ease of administration or ease of pricing, having one pricing model, it could potentially reduce some administrative costs for insurers as well.
So I got to be the bad cop. market merger could mean winners and losers. And based on our best guesses, the likely losers, to the extent there are going to be any, are small groups. And the reason is that small groups, the range of pricing for small groups tends to be narrower right now than the range of pricing for individual policies. So the likelihood or potential for cross-subsidies to go from small group purchasers to individual purchasers thus exists. As April said, we don't have actual data to understand how big of a risk that is. I suspect the risk is going to differ from marketplace to marketplace and from state to state. Some states, for example, have merged their markets already. Some states have had guaranteed issue for individual. So some of those pricing differences are smoothed out. But that is one of the risks of merging of the markets. You could have an impact on small groups. That impact may then encourage some small groups to self-insure, further reducing the number of entities in the regulated, in the state-regulated space. And we're looking at more, if that were to occur, it would likely occur in that group 51 to 100. So we'd be looking at essentially the exchange just serving 50 and below. It could also lead some small groups to conclude that, you know, I'll just take my chances with a potential penalty with respect to any subsidies and just drop coverage altogether. In the early years, there's a potential for some market premium instability or price shock for small groups as a relationship of what we talked about in bullet one, which is that there may be some cross subsidies flowing from small groups to individuals. And lastly, as April has talked about, the ability to provide wellness discounts in the individual marketplace is conditioned on falling into the 10-state demo project. If we're one of the states that doesn't fall into the 10-state demo project, then you do have a pretty significant fiscal incentive to stay in one or the other market. And if you remove that, marketplace, then the availability of the discounts may disappear. So that is one of the considerations that you want to think about, or at least get more information about, before you make a decision on whether that market merger makes sense. That's our presentation on the various risk adjustment methods contemplated under PACA, and we'd be glad to answer any questions.
So why don't I start by asking a few questions, and then you can all jot down your questions, and we'll get to everybody. With risk adjustment, if the small group and individual market were not merged, would you have a different risk adjustment mechanism for the small group than the individual market, or would you still have one risk adjustment mechanism?
Madam Chair, the method of doing risk adjustment could be the same, but the transfer of funds between within the individual market and the small group market, that transfer of funds would be different between the two.
So I'm going to ask my question over again. I'm not talking about the method you use to determine risk adjustment. I'm talking about whether you would have two separate funds.
Yes.
To actually give money to plans who need money because they need a risk adjustment. Would you have two separate pools of money, one for the individual market and one for the small group market?
Madam Chair, yes, you would.
Then the second question I have is, what risk adjustment option does the Department of Human Services use for their programs today of the ones that you have listed on the risk adjustment options data sheet slide?
So related to the Department of Human Services, they are getting claims-based data or encounter data. So they are using encounter data as half of the risk adjustment for their payments. The other half of the risk adjustment is based on demographic information, so age, sex, you know, those types of demographic information. In terms of the method that's being used, they would be classified under a prospective method of using that, given that they're using historical claims-based data to set future payments to the plans, but that's based on an aggregate plan level and not an individual level, individual enrollee type level.
And In your slide about risk adjustment options, you talk about an adjusted perspective claims data system. If you have one or don't have one, the advantages or disadvantages. We have one, don't we?
Yes.
So the disadvantages of not having one would be irrelevant to our conversation.
That's correct.
Are there other questions? Representative Huntley?
When you're talking about demographic risk adjustment, does that include income levels of the people in the two groups? Because we're going to probably have lower income people in the exchange and higher income people out of the exchange, and there's a direct correlation between income and health.
Mr. Manchera and Representative Huntley, the demographic information that could be used for risk adjustment is something that's not defined. It could be a broad range of things. It could include income if that's something that the state would want and that HHS would be okay with the state using. You need to determine where that information would come from to be able to be used in that mechanism.
Representative Huntley.
Madam Chair and Ms. Malmov, I think you probably answered, but there's also some genetic predispositions, particularly if you look at diabetes. In certain Indian tribes are much more likely to have there's Indian tribes in Arizona that have more than half the people have diabetes. Could that be included in this?
Mr. Manchin, Representative Huntley, again, potentially could be used as a demographic characteristics if it's something that was deemed that people would find useful to do. Again, there's no strict definition of what the demographic characteristics that could be used in that.
Ms. Mamla, the slide on risk adjustment options kind of implies that you just choose one of these, but according to the answer you gave me about how DHS does it, they use a combination of factors, and so that would be possible.
Yes. Madam Chair, yes. The four categories that are on there are just a broad representation of the different ways that you could do risk adjustment. I don't think that there would be any prohibition on combining them in any way. It would be something to talk with HHS about.
Other questions?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Malmov. It's sort of a follow-up to Representative Huntley's question in that the demographic data in the past, I think, has traditionally been age and sex. But I'm concerned that as we learn more, many of you saw the headlines on the Wilder study, and I think Blue Cross Blue Shield Foundation may have been a partner in it or at least helped get more attention to it. There's a lot more than in predictability of health if you start looking at race, at geographic neighborhood. I mean, it's pretty interesting when your life expectancy is by neighborhood, by your race. And I am concerned about how we apply this. Will incent the carriers to serve certain people and avoid other people? And that if you do it on diagnosis and you recognize diabetes as an expensive claim, insurers will be incented to create diabetes centers of excellence. But if you don't have HIV as a diagnosis recognized in that, that's for that special risk adjustment financial sharing, you may not want to set up HIV clinics or locate in neighborhoods that have high risk for STDs. And I'm concerned that the same thing could be true on the demographic data if people were to start to get to a different level of not just age and sex, but start going down to income or zip code. If we did it right, it would actually incent people to go to serve underserved populations and areas. But if we don't, it may lead them to redlining. And I'd be real interested if you've got any models that really look at creating disincentives to redline areas where there's concentration of people of different racial groups, such as tribal groups that are subject to diabetes or income status, because I do think how we structure this will decide who we return. Are you aware of anyone who's using those kind of data in a risk adjustment model?
Mr. Madam Chair and Representative Loeffler, I'll just report on the things that I've received from Mr. Knutson regarding some of the modeling that they are doing with some different risk adjustment models to see what kind of accuracy they are getting with different models to predict the different costs that those individuals have. Some of the models that they are running are different types of diagnosis, what you would include in a diagnosis-based approach, and they are comparing those to what you would get through a pure demographic-based approach that's primarily based on age and sex. None of those models to date have included things around income or geography or those types of variables. The one thing that I will communicate that Mr. Knutson asked me to actively communicate to this group is that they are modeling different types of risk adjustment models, and that if there are ideas for things that could be modeled, that group is open to modeling those types of ideas.
Thank you.
Questions?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. April, is there currently an initiative in the state to have a statewide data pool, or is that not being considered? And if there isn't one, is that something that this committee should be discussing moving forward?
Mr. Madam Chair, and I'm going to mispronounce your name again, Cathal. Are you referring to like a claims-based data pool of claims?
All
ABCD.
Right. Yeah. Minnesota currently has an all-payer claims database that we have been collecting information for. That information under statute right now is only allowed to be used for our provider peer grouping system. So we do have the information in a claims-based database, but we are using it for that sole purpose.
In follow-up to that, is that something that could change? Do we need new laws or
change the law?
Mr. Madam Chair and Mr. Cathal, if that is something that the legislature would decide that that's something that they would like to do, I think that the ball is in their court for that.
Well, the ball has to be in somebody's court, so I guess that's where it is. Questions?
Madam Chair, April, this is to follow up on Senator Berkman's earlier question about the risk adjustment in the public programs, specifically in the Medicaid program. How long have we been doing risk adjustment, and have we done an evaluation of how well that method of risk adjustment is working?
Mr. Madam Chair and Ms. O'Connell, what I can report is based on my conversations with DHS that we have been doing risk adjustment since the year 2000. And over the first few years of that risk adjustment method, they varied or phased in the percentage that was based on demographics versus the percentage that was based on diagnosis or based on claims data. So it was more based on demographics at the start and then phased into a 50-50 match of demographics and claims-based data. In terms of evaluation, that's not something that I am knowledgeable of at this time as to what they've been doing with that. But we can bring that question back to DHS. And
maybe there's somebody here that can answer it later when we get done with the questions we have for you. And maybe at that time we could also find out what demographic data is being used. Yes.
Senator Berglund and April, I have a couple questions about the market merger issues. So we don't currently know the risk profiles of the individual and small group markets. Is that right?
Mr. Madam Chair and Ms. Bullitt, yes, that's correct.
So Madam Chair and April, couldn't that be something that we could do analysis of using the claims database? Is there identifying information of who's in the individual and small group market?
Mr. Madam Chair, given what we are directed in statute to use the claims data for, we are only allowed to use it for peer grouping. So we would not be able to use that information at this time for that purpose.
Madam Chair and April, but if that were changed, wouldn't that be just the ideal resource to be able to assess whether what Manny says the individual market has a higher risk profile?
Potentially, I would have to go back and see what type of information we're collecting and whether we're collecting individual and small group market indicators in that data. I'm just not clear on that point at this time.
Okay, and Madam Chair and April, the other thing I was thinking about, and when you're talking about merging the markets, you're not talking about MSHA at this moment, right? Because merging individual small group is one thing, but the merging MSHA into a pool is another whole nother issue in terms of the risk profile and the concerns about raising premiums and all of that. So it seems like those might be two separate.
This would happen in 2014 or slightly before that time. There would be guaranteed issue. So essentially,
yeah.
You would be merging MSHA into it.
And Madam Chair and April Manny, I think we have to really look at what that's going to do to those pools, those 30,000 people, because those are the high-risk pools that are high-risk individuals that are not in the individual market right now. So we basically have a pretty low risk profile because we've taken all the high-risk people out. So I just be cautious about when we're talking about merging those markets that MSHA has included.
We are not talking about merging those markets. The federal law does that.
No.
We are talking about whether to merge the individual and small group.
Right.
But MSHA would automatically be merged into the individual market without
yeah.
us doing anything. Other questions?
Madam Chair, just for some information on looking at the small group and the individual into the MSHA question, we have done some back of the envelope, and so I would say that the important thing to realize is this is with current enrollment assumptions. So if the individual market grows and the denominator changes, the numbers change. But if you were to take MCHA with its 27,000 enrollees, given the losses of that population, and move them into the individual market, so small group stays apart, but you move that in, that's about a 25% increase in individual premiums. So I think people would see sticker shock if they got an individual increase that was 25%. That doesn't count trend. That doesn't count changes of benefits. That's just taking the risk profile of the people in MCHA and putting them in the individual market. If you were to take MCHA...
Can you say that again? I'm sorry.
But just one other thing, that needs to be... We need the whole picture in every discussion we have about this. So if the individual market is kept separate and MCHA becomes part of it, those enrollees, every one of those people up to 400% of poverty are getting subsidized.
Madam Chair, I understand that, and I just was going to give the example of if you merge individual and small group together as well, what happens to those numbers, just for context?
Well, and then the other thing we need to remember is that the small group market does subsidize MCHA today.
Madam Chair, exactly, and so that's part of the equation that you would have to consider is
right.
with that 2.5, 2.6, 2.7% assessment, what do you do with that number? Now, you could certainly either get rid of that, and that would take that off small group, or you could leave that in place to further mitigate any sort of market destabilization that may occur. If you took the individual MCHA 27,000 and put them into a merged market of small group and individual, you're spreading that more broadly, the impact would be a 7% increase across that group. So the thoughts that this group really has to look at and more actuarial work, this is very back of the envelope. It doesn't consider conversion populations. It doesn't consider Minnesota care populations who may also move into that, who we know is a higher risk than the regular individual market today. So all of that has to be looked at. The point is the broader base you spread it, the less of the impact. However, small group would have no impact if they were kept outside of it, but the impact to individual market would be much more. So this is a perfect example of something in-depth actuarial works, but I just wanted to share kind of from a big picture, that's what the numbers look like.
And, Ms. Coleman, if they were merged, and you're right that it would be a 7% increase across the board, in the individual market, the 7% would be subsidized, but in the small group market, it would not.
From the federal subsidies standpoint,
right.
Yes.
So
yes.
I think that is a factor that needs to be considered also.
Unless there are individuals in the small group market who were under the circumstance where there would also be a subsidy for small group, which is
right,
possible.
But that would be pretty hard to estimate how many would be in that situation. Other questions?
She says one.
Yes.
Sure, Madam Chair, April. Two questions relating to the risk adjustment options. So you mentioned Utah and their use of a health assessment, basically a stated response tool. Have they done any kind of subsequent evaluation of how well that tool is actually predicting actual claims experience at this point, or is it too new to be able to do that?
I think they've only had about a month of experience of having the individual market in the exchange. So,
Mr. Madam Chair, and Dr. Abraham, Utah, their health assessment that they've been doing for their small group market that's in there has been going for about 9 months. They're in the process now of looking through how well that's working. In some conversations with them, some of the things that they are thinking about is combining that risk, that health assessment tool with, they also have an all-payer claims database, and using both of those sources of information to help in predictive accuracy.
And
but the 9 months is only in the small group market that they've been.
Madam Chair,
so
that's
they
correct.
Don't have any real, I mean, they don't have much longevity on serving the individual market through the exchange.
Madam Chair, you're correct that they're just using this with their small group market, but those individuals are picking individual-based policies through different insurers, and so they're using that to compensate for that employee choice among those insurers.
One follow-up question, please. Regarding the different options with respect to using diagnosis or claims-based data to do the modeling, do you have a sense of kind of the relative kind of accuracy differences across those methods? So how much better do certain types of methods perform relative to others?
Mr. Madam Chair and Dr. Abraham, just based on some initial analysis that has recently come out from the Academy of Actuaries, there are some differences between using diagnosis-based information and demographic information. If I'm remembering this correctly, the accuracy is about 5 times higher using diagnosis-based information than just purely using demographic information. But again, that demographic information is primarily based on using age and sex and those types of demographics.
Thank you.
Yes.
Madam Chair, Ms. Momov, just a quick follow-on question. Is there any indication that that accuracy of claims data may get better as ICD-9 rolls to ICD-10? There'll be more codes, so as a non-actuary, I should think that it would provide more accuracy, but I don't know.
Mr. and Madam Chair, I'm also not quite sure on that. I have not read anything as to that effect yet.
Well, and, you know, other methods are only being used to guess at what somebody's diagnosis might be or might become. I mean, I wouldn't think that, you know, even with the most sophisticated tool, that would be accurate either.
And Madam Chair, and that's the one reason why, one of the points that I made earlier is even if you do risk adjustment, there's still that potential for adverse selection, you know, between the exchange and the outside market. So there are other things to consider as well to reduce that adverse selection.
Other questions?
Madam Chair, and this is for Ms. Coleman. You said at the beginning that the self-insured are going to participate in the cost of the risk adjustment. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And
I'm sorry, in the reinsurance program.
Okay, just the reinsurance? So not, yeah. Okay, because MSHA right now is paid for primarily by small businesses.
By the fully insured
market, but primarily from small businesses. But so none of that reinsurance could be used for this?
No, the reinsurance program is intended just to be a 3-year bridge until this risk adjustment methodology comes into effect.
Questions? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to our guests from Commerce. Trying to weigh in my head the pros and cons of the market merger, the individual and the small group. And currently, state policy incents small employers to insure their workers at a level of 50% of premium. In exchange for that, they get rate protection as well as guaranteed issue. Can you imagine in a merged market that we could continue those incentives for small employers to contribute at that level and to have in exchange some rate protection
in a merged
market?
I'm having difficulty trying to determine how you administer that, just from an administrative purpose. If your marketplace contemplates both purchase on a group basis and on a defined contribution basis. And it's more getting my head around how you track whatever incentives or whatever gimmies you might want to give to small employers in that scenario, particularly when one of the biggest bonuses you have right now is guaranteed issue. And now that's going to apply to everyone in 2014. So that incentive now applies to everyone. So could it be done? I suppose I'm just having difficulty envisioning how it works out administratively.
Well, I mean, one way I have thought about it is if you said if a small employer pays 50% of a silver-rated policy, then you know, they're within a certain rate band for all the policies that they purchase, or they purchase as a group, as they currently do. But I'm still thinking through how that might work as well. So that's why I wanted you to join me in doing that, because I think, quite honestly, for the small businesses, it's not, for some it might be the guaranteed issue that's the major carrot, but I think in this economic climate, it's the rate increase protection that's most valued by most of the small employers currently.
Madam Chair, so Loeffler, that would also apply outside the exchange, of course, because you'd have to have the same. Well, it would be probably a good idea to have the same rating rules inside and outside. So, to the extent you're wanting to do this, so it's a bigger than an exchange issue, I guess is what I would say. Contemplating some rate upside protection. I will share thinking with you.
Your questions? Yes.
Madam Chair and departments, I know that there's some concern about the grandfathered plans, and are you aware of like who those are and how many we have that would these would not affect at all in our market?
Madam Chair, Ms. Blewett. Our sense is the number of grandfathered plans are shrinking, that folks who started this year, once the reg came out, thinking they were going to be grandfathered, have discovered as they go through the process, particularly as they get closer to open enrollment, that it's not making any more sense for them to remain grandfathered. So without giving you an exact number, our sense directionally is there will be fewer of them by the time 2014 rolls around.
And Madam Chair and Manny, could you tell me what grandfathered, what the definition is? Are those small groups who already have, offer and provide health insurance? Or?
Madam Chair, members, Ms. Blewett, grandfathered plans are plans that were in existence prior to March 23rd of this year, and that don't make material changes with respect to their benefits that primarily result in increased cost to the enrollee or member, or a material reduction in coverage. So that's a very interesting term of art in determining whether or not a particular change results in loss of grandfathering status. In addition, grandfathered plans don't remain in amber forever. There are some provisions of PACA that apply to all plans, whether grandfathered or not. So I guess what we're hearing from folks is that the material differences between grandfathered and non-grandfathered plans are being offset by the administrative difficulties in making sure, in limiting their ability to be creative or flexible in how they want to create plan design. So in order to stay grandfathered, they had to give up some degree of flexibility and other things they want to do. And what we're hearing is that they don't want to give up the flexibility.
Madam Chair, and Manny, is there a time frame? So they have to, do they have to apply to you to get approval for not being part of the, and are they would they be exempt from the risk adjustment as well as the participating in the exchange?
With respect to applying to us for approval, they do make filings designated whether a certain change is for a grandfathered plan or non-grandfathered plan, but they don't apply on an individual policy basis, if that's your question. So they designate a product as being their grandfathered product and their non-grandfathered product. We don't know on a specific account basis whether or not an account is grandfathered or not. With respect to the risk control, April, do you know, does it apply to both?
For the risk adjustment, the grandfathered plans are not incorporated into the risk adjustment.
Madam Chair, I guess I just some concern about who's going to be in and out of, if they're, some of the small group market is an individual market, if they're grandfathered, then that will be less that'll be integrated in the pool, and be nice to have some estimate of how many at some point if we could.
Madam Chair, Ms. Blute, one of the things we'll have to check on, pooling of the mark of the risk pools may still apply across all plans, whether grandfathered or not. So that might mitigate some of the...
Yeah.
We'll get back to the committee, okay. But that might mitigate some of that sort of incentive to game.
Yeah, thank you.
Mr. Munson-Regala, my understanding was that that the grandfathering is really only a feature between now and 2014. I mean, there'll be plans that don't have to provide guarantee issue after 2014 and some of the other things that would apply to grandfathered plans now.
Over time, it's going to become next to impossible, right, to meet the change requirements?
Yes.
That's our sense from talking to the marketplace. So, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, I think theoretically someone could figure out a way to keep a plan indefinitely grandfathered. I think pragmatically what we're hearing from the marketplace is that's not something that they contemplate they want to do beyond 2014.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question for Ms. Todd-Malmov on the last slide back to the question of the market merger. Just wondering on the list of pros there whether you think it would be reasonable to add if the legislature were to create an exchange with a pooling of the purchasing power and using that to negotiate on cost or quality or whatever else the exchange decided to use it for, that having a merged market because of the scale would increase the negotiating power?
Mr. Mem Chair and Mr. Cryan, is that how you say that? Okay. need to think about this a little bit. If you merge the markets and the risk was pooled, under purchasing power, this is still an area where we're a little uncertain how this applies inside and outside the exchange, because small group and individual, whether it's a merged market inside the exchange and outside the exchange, if there are plans that are the same inside and outside, they have to have the same premium. And so the only way that would apply or that would be a benefit would be if there are completely separate plans inside and outside the exchange. So at this point, we're still trying to think through, you know, what the impact is of that purchaser-type role for the exchange and how that relates to that risk pooling requirement of plans inside and outside.
Well, and you could have the same rules if you're trying to encourage quality, for example. You could have the same rules for the small group market as you did for the individual market without merging them.
15 minutes.
For the purposes of, you know, creating products or incentivizing people to purchase products that had more quality, you could do that without merging the markets.
Madam Chair, that's correct. That's correct. A market merger would merge the pools, the risk pool of the individual and the small group market, but you can still have them separate, and they would have the same rating rules and could have the same product rules. That's correct.
Other questions? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm thinking through some timing and coordination issues with the reinsurance and risk adjustment. If reinsurance is supposed to be something that's just temporary for 3 years, I'm presuming that that's to aid the risk adjustment process, that we're going to implement a risk adjustment process. There's going to be some mistakes. We're going to maybe need to brush up those mistakes with the reinsurance mechanism. But I assume we could also maybe just wait to implement risk adjustment until after reinsurance, the reinsurance program is over. And I'm wondering if there's going to be incentives for people to advocate to delay the risk adjustment mechanism because through those 3 years we're going to have these large employers and the self-insureds contributing to that reinsurance mechanism. And just wondering your thoughts on timing. Is the risk adjustment something that we need to be starting on right now? Is that something that, and then the reinsurance cleans up? Or how is that, do you think, is going to work out and play out?
Mr. Madam Chair and Mr. Nelson, the reinsurance mechanism needs to be working in 2014. It's not something that can be delayed. So given between now and then, work would need to happen to get that ready by 2014, both by HHS and however the states decide that they're going to deal with exchanges. The purpose of having the reinsurance and the risk corridors and all of those things in those first 3 years is that you will have some market instability during those first 3 years because of all of the changes that are happening. And those three together are, even though we're not quite sure how the three of them will work together yet, because that guidance is still forthcoming from HHS, that those three together will help to reduce some of the issues that you would get from instability.
Mr. Nelson, as I look at 1342 and 1343, it says, with respect to risk corridors, the Secretary shall establish and administer, so that appears to leave it out of our discretion. And with respect to risk adjustment, using the criteria and methods developed under Section B, each state shall assess a charge on health plans, and so that seems to suggest that we've got to have a methodology in place.
Okay.
I suspect you may be able to talk to HHS about phase-in or implementation, but that would require a waiver more than likely.
Other questions?
Madam Chair and Ms. Todd Malmov, could you just send me, if you've got like a two-page thing on the wellness discount demonstration projects.
Mr. Madam Chair, Mr. Huntley, yes, we can send you that language.
Why don't you make that available to the whole group?
Can do that.
Any other questions? Now, thank you very much. We'll move on then to the discussion about navigators and brokers. And we're going to start with Tom Pender.
American Indian is so much higher than the obesity is. Apple-shaped inflation, they're much higher. Maybe some connection.
Pender, you're on first, I think.
Yes. Madam Chair and members of the work group, I'm Tom Pender from the Research Department in the House of Representatives. And my colleagues, Katie Cavanaugh and Randy Chun, and I were asked to speak on the things involving the navigators in health insurance exchanges. And we're doing four separate short little presentations here. I'm doing the first one and the last one, and they're doing the ones in between, and we put them together here in one handout. So you have a handout here that has the text of four little short presentations. The federal health reform law, I'll refer to it as PPACA, requires state health insurance exchanges to establish a program for awarding grants to what it calls navigators. And navigators, in simple terms, are basically organizations or individuals that would help people enroll through the exchange, to help them navigate the system, in addition to the website and other help that the exchange provides. And the law doesn't require people to use these navigators in order to enroll in health exchange products sold through the exchange. The way Congress formats its legislation, the material in their 2,500-page bill, the part that covered navigators is about 4 pages. But if you format it a normal way without quadruple spacing and huge type and so on, it comes out to be about 1 page. So that's the amount of information we're given in the bill about navigators. And much of the detail is going to come from federal regulations by the Department of Health and Human Services. The grants to navigators are required by the federal law are required to come out of the exchange's operational funds and not from federal funds that are provided to establish the exchange. So in other words, the state's going to have to figure out a way to cover these grants that federal law requires us to make to navigators. And we need to keep in mind that if the exchange is going to be up and running by January 1st, 2014, and there's going to be presumably an open enrollment period in the fall of 2013, I'm assuming here we're not going to start earlier than 2014, but we could, of course. We'd need to have navigators presumably certified and trained in time for the open enrollment period before 2014 or earlier if the exchange is going to start earlier. In this roughly one page in the federal law, the law does provide some guidance for states on navigators, including eligibility and standards. A potential navigator has to demonstrate to the exchange the following things in order to be eligible. They have to have existing relationships or the ability to establish relationships with employers, employees, consumers, including uninsured and underinsured people, or self-employed individuals. And the federal law, I checked this carefully, does say or there. So presumably a navigator could specialize just in one of those four types of enrollees. The bill also provides a list of what types of entities or individuals can be navigators, and I've included that here on the first page of the handout, kind of in the middle there, and I'm not going to go through and read the list to you. And I'll point out that it gives some evidence that lots of groups decided they wanted to make sure they were included in this list, maybe just in case they decided later they wanted to be navigators. And you'd think that the reference to trade, industry, and professional associations would cover most of these kind of organizations, but they seem to want to make sure that they were specifically listed. I'll also point out that it includes licensed insurance agents and brokers, which seems to me to be the only individual people who could be individuals here as opposed to organizations. And then there's a catch-all category, other entities capable of carrying out the duties and meeting the standards for navigators. And presumably when the federal regulations on this come out, we may get more detail and on what those other entities might be or maybe won't be allowed to be. The federal law also provides two or three standards for navigators. First, a navigator can't be a health insurance issuer. And when the bill uses that term, it means an insurance company or an HMO or a Blue Cross type Blue Shield organization. In other words, the entity that's providing the insurance. Also, navigators aren't allowed to receive any payment directly or indirectly from a health insurance issuer in connection with the enrollment of people in a qualified health plan provided by that health insurance issuer. So there's a conflict of interest kind of limit there on what navigators can be paid for or receive other consideration. In addition, the law specifically states that additional standards are to be set by the Secretary of Health and Human Services, including standards to avoid other conflicts of interest that, that navigators might face. The bill also, the law, also lists the responsibilities of a navigator, that they're to provide public education activities to raise awareness of the availability of coverage through the exchange. They're required to distribute fair and impartial information concerning enrollment in coverage through the exchange, including information about the availability of premium tax credits and cost-sharing reductions for people within the income range that are eligible for those. They're required to facilitate enrollment in plans offered through the exchange and provide referrals to the appropriate state agency for any enrollee with a grievance, complaint, or question. And apparently, so the navigators aren't required to actually necessarily answer the question or deal with the grievance or complaint, but are at least a minimum required to refer it. Well, I assume they could probably, if they feel competent, they could probably deal with it also. And they're also required to provide information in a manner that is culturally and linguistically appropriate to the needs of the population served by the exchange. And I want to point out here that in contrast to the list on the first page of the types of existing relationships where there was an or, this list has an and there before the last item on the list and the second to the last. So it appears as if a navigator would have to be able to perform all of these functions and couldn't cherry-pick or limit themselves by, for instance, deciding they're not going to provide that last function in the list of providing information in a way that's culturally and linguistically appropriate. In this list of responsibilities, one thing that kind of stands out to me is that there's no reference to dealing with people who are eligible for Medicaid, Minnesota Care, or other public programs. The wording is very clear that everything these navigators are supposed to do involve dealing with qualified health plans, which are basically health plans that are provided through the exchange. And maybe this is something that will be dealt with in the forthcoming regulations, simply saying what should a navigator do if the navigator gets contacted by someone who might be eligible for one of the public programs. It seems sort of obvious they should somehow make some kind of initial determination and refer the person to someone who maybe has more expertise in that subject. So anyway, I think to conclude, this is pretty much what the information the bill gives us about navigators. Federal guidance will be forthcoming, and obviously there's a lot of uncertainty about the role of navigators.
I think we'll just take the questions at the end for everybody since we're running a little behind on our time. So, Ms. Kavanagh, why don't you continue?
My name is Katie Kavanagh from Senate Council, and I was asked to talk about the use of navigators or brokers in the Utah Health Exchange and the Massachusetts Health Connector. I think when you're looking at the role of brokers in these exchanges, you need to keep in mind the structure and the purpose of these exchanges as well as the level of involvement that the brokers have in the insurance market within the state prior to the development of the exchange. If we look at Utah, that health exchange is set up as a market organizer to provide impartial information on health plans to enable consumers to compare plans and to purchase the coverage through standardized electronic system. The exchange started as a pilot in 2009 for small employers, employers with 2 to 50 employees. This pilot was expanded this year, this fall actually, to include large employers. The exchange is set up as a public agency. It has 2 employees. The office contracts with 2 vendors, One of the vendor is responsible to market and enroll the employees from the participating employers. And the other vendor is to collect the premiums from the employers and pay the insurance carriers and brokers. The way the exchange is set up to work, employers sign up by completing an online application. The application is then approved. The employer is notified of this approval, and the employer then determines the level of contribution the employer will make towards the employee's health coverage. Once the employer has enrolled in this defined contribution plan, then the employee uses the exchange to compare the multiple health plans that are available, and they pick the coverage that meets the employee's needs. The employee is then instructed to complete an online individual health insurance application for that particular health plan. There are four health carriers that are currently participating in the exchange with 67 different health plans offered. The role that the brokers play at Utah, before the brokers play an influential role in the Utah market, especially in the small employer market. So Utah used brokers to educate the business community and their employees about the benefits of the defined compensation marketplace that's used in the exchange. And in turn, initially the employers were required to designate a broker as part of the application. This is no longer a requirement as of September of this year for the upcoming plan year that's to begin January 1st of 2011, but employers are still encouraged to work with a broker. To participate in the exchange, a broker must be registered with the exchange, and to be registered, the broker must be licensed with the Utah Department of Insurance. It must be appointed with the majority of the health carriers that are participating in the exchange. They must register with Health Equity, which is the vendor that pays the broker compensation for the exchange, and then they are provided a registration number. And they must complete a separate training program that consists of classes that are approved by the Utah Department of Insurance. If a broker is used, then the broker assists the employer in obtaining and completing the application form. Once the employer is approved to enter the exchange, then the broker can assist the employees with the enrollment process and interact as much as the employer and the employees feel necessary. And this really will depend on how computer savvy the employer and the employees are. Once the employer group is signed up, the broker then serves the employer account just like they would serve any other account, and they would be working as an intermediary between the employer employees in the exchange. If the broker is selected by a participating employer, the broker would receive a commission of $37 per participating employee per month, and there is also going to be an exchange fee of $6 that it goes to cover the cost of operating the exchange. The small employer group decides not to use a broker. They are still charged this $37, and this amount then would goes to fund a customer interactive service center, which is operated by one of the vendors, and this center provides support 24/7 to the groups that are participating in the exchange. And looking at Massachusetts, again, their Health Connector began in 2006. It was set up as a quasi-public agency with a public governing board established by the legislature and has 45 employees. It has a number of other specific functions as well as serving as a selective contractor contracts with select groups of health carriers and offers a limited number of health plans that meet the plan design parameters that have been established by the administrators of the connector. It also conducts outreach, education, and marketing to inform individuals, employers, and brokers of the opportunities that are offered through the connector. It also has to meet a number of regulatory responsibilities, including the establishment and operation of the two exchanges. And these two exchanges are the Commonwealth Care and the Commonwealth Choice. The Commonwealth CARE was first launched in 2006. It's a subsidized program for adults who are not offered employer-sponsored insurance and are not eligible for Medicare or Medicaid and who earn up to 300% of poverty. The coverage is offered through five plans, and there are 185,000 members currently in that program. Commonwealth Choice began in 2007, and this is a program for the unsubsidized individuals and the small employer groups. And standardized coverage options are offered through seven participating health carriers, and these plans represent about approximately 90% of the commercial licensed health insurance market in the state. And each of the plans offered through the connector by these carriers may be purchased directly by the individual from the individual carrier. Currently, this program has 36,000 members, and most of those are non-group members. There is also the Business Express program, and this is the program that began as a pilot in 2009 for small employers with 50 or fewer employees. And through this program, the employer sets a contribution amount, and then the employees choose a health plan from the health plan options that are available through Commonwealth Choice. And initially, this pilot was started by the connector going to a limited number of brokers in the state and providing these brokers with the opportunity of offering this contributory payment plan to small employers. And this option has since morphed into the Business Express program that allows small employers to access the program directly through the connector or access the program through a broker. And in Massachusetts as well as Utah, the brokers play an influential role in the insurance market, especially in the small employer market. Currently, approximately 90% of small employers work through a broker, and most of these small employers purchase coverage outside of the connector. If brokers who are participating in the program, the commission was initially 2.5% of total premium amount, and this has since been changed to $10 per employee per month for employers with 1 to 5 employees. And it remains at 2.5% of the total premium for employers with 6 to 50 employees. Commissions for these same plans sold outside the connector tend to be higher in the 3 to 5% total premium range. And there is no difference in the premiums in terms of whether an employer uses a broker or not. If a broker is not used, then the amount of the premium that is contributed to the broker's commission is used by the connector for administrative costs. And brokers are also required, if they participate in the program, to participate in approximately 4 days of training on the program that's available. And finally, you know, I think it's worth noting that when health care reform was passed in Massachusetts, the state instituted an aggressive, proactive, multi-pronged outreach education enrollment campaign, and they partnered with a number of organizations, community-based advocacy groups, corporate and civic groups, faith groups, the healthcare community, unions, business groups. And this was a multi-million dollar effort, and it included direct mail, included grassroots outreach, paid advertising, promotional activities, billboards, circulars, public service announcements, seminars, and grants to community organizations. There were also a number of community-based enrollment events that took place at various venues like baseball games or whatnot. It was a pretty expansive effort. And I think due to that effort, there was this effort was very essential in getting this information out to the individuals and businesses of Massachusetts, and it was essential in the success of their exchange today.
Okay, Randall Chung.
Madam Chair, Randy Chung with the House Research Department. I'll be describing some of the enrollment assistance.
If you could just speak up a little bit so the microphone picks you up.
I'll be describing some of the enrollment assistance that's available to applicants for Minnesota healthcare programs. Contrary to what's on the agenda, I won't be talking about the use of navigators in private coverage. I think that's something that might be covered in the broker presentation later. I'll spend most of my time describing the Minnesota Community Application Assistance Program, also known as MINCA, which has a number of navigator-like features. And I'll end then by briefly mentioning other sources of enrollment assistance for state healthcare program enrollees. The overall goal of the MINCA program is to help people enroll in state healthcare programs by providing outreach and application assistance through participating community organizations. And a community organization can be nonprofit or for-profit. It has to have ongoing contact with an uninsured population and must not already be receiving state or federal funding for application assistance. Insurance brokers are allowed to participate in the program. They need to meet the same standards as the community organization. And also, individuals can obtain assistance through any community organization that serves the county in which they live. So a community organization participates in the program at one of three levels. A level one organization is subject to the most requirements from DHS, and level three, the fewest. Some of these requirements are outlined on page 9, which is a DHS table that I won't specifically be going over. A level one organization is referred to as a Minnesota Community Application Agent. And among other things, a level one organization must serve as an application site, assist individuals in completing the healthcare program's application form and collecting necessary documentation, must offer the use of fax and copy services, and provide follow-up as needed until DHS makes an eligibility decision. A level one organization receives a $25 application bonus for each applicant who is enrolled in a Minnesota healthcare program. The authorizing language also states that an organization may provide an applicant with a gift certificate or other incentive upon enrollment. A level two organization provides information and referrals for application assistance. It can provide some help with completing an application form, but usually doesn't work through the whole process with the applicant. It's not eligible for an application bonus. A level three organization focuses primarily on outreach and raising awareness through things such as health fairs and group presentations. Again, it doesn't normally assist with applications. It's not eligible for the $25 bonus. There are some requirements for the staff of level one organizations. A staff member who assists with applications needs to be certified by the Department of Human Services as an agent by completing one day of training. And the use of the term agent here in this context does not mean, you know, the requirements for an insurance agent or broker. It's just they just use the same term. Agents are required to submit applications by fax to the Resource Center, which I'll mention later, within 25 days of the date of application, along with other materials and verifications. These agents enter a 3-digit identification number, and that identifies them for any application bonus that they receive. The program established a Resource Center. This provides various levels of support to community organizations, with the most support being provided to level one organizations. For example, level one organizations receive training. They receive training and presentations from the department, site visits and technical assistance, access to a call center, outreach materials, and access to the MINCA website. I'll go over now some program statistics that as of October 2010. There are 120 community organizations that provide application assistance at the level one level. One of these is an insurance broker who has been enrolled in the program since 2008, which is when the program started. There are 200 organizations that provide information referral, so these are level two organizations. Since 2008, participating organizations have submitted 22,839 applications for 33,286 individuals. 14,771 applications have been successful. These people have been enrolled in a Minnesota healthcare program. And the amount of application bonuses paid out is $369,275. And these were payments to 80 organizations. The language establishing the program makes funding subject to the available appropriation. The original funding for the program for the 2010-2011 biennium was $160,000 from the Healthcare Access Fund, $360,000 from the General Fund. The governor had initially unallotted this $360,000 General Fund appropriation. The 2010 legislature voided the governor's unallotment and instead, eliminated the funding for that biennium from the General Fund. So the current funding is $160,000 from the Healthcare Access Fund. I need to make a correction. On the last bullet on page 8, it should read, this funding is being used to provide application bonuses for new enrollees in all three programs. There is some confusion about the use of that fund, so my apologies for that. Turning, I guess, to page 10, I'll just briefly go over some other sources of enrollment assistance. First, there is the Minnesota Senior Linkage Line, which is operated in all counties by the Area Agencies on Aging. This program provides assistance in planning for and accessing long-term care services, including but not limited to help in applying for Medicare and medical assistance, and also provides health insurance counseling. The program also provides application assistance to Medicare enrollees who are applying for a low-income prescription drug subsidy. And then these individuals are then referred to DHS. In return, the information is then provided to the senior linkage line who follows up with each enrollee. The county human services agencies administer the MA and GAMC programs under the supervision of DHS. They have the option of processing Minnesota Care applications, and I believe there'll be a full presentation on this later today. These counties are required to accept and process applications and to reevaluate recipient eligibility. They're also required to assist applicants who have difficulty completing an application or in obtaining required documentation. And then finally, each applicant and enrollee can designate an authorized representative, such as a family member, friend, or other person to act on behalf of that applicant in the application process. And this representative could, for example, provide assistance in completing an application or renewal or in obtaining required verifications.
Mr. Pender?
Madam Chair, I'm going to do the final part of this presentation, page 11 of the handout. I was asked to cover pros and cons of possible options the state might have in dealing with navigators and exchanges. So I'll be talking about things that states might be able to do. And this is very speculative because, as I've said, there's about one page of stuff in the bill on navigators, and you've already heard it, and it doesn't really say very much about the details. But I just sort of picked three options here, and I'll just quickly go through the pros and cons of them. One option is to allow navigators to specialize a little more than is maybe shown in the wording of the statute, by specializing in certain types of enrollees or certain types of products, just in subsidized or unsubsidized enrollees or individual or group products or whatever. You remember the list on the first page here, which said that you have to have existing relationships with employers, employees, consumers, or self-employed individuals, already gives them some ability to pick and choose. And some groups might want to be more specific than that. So if we look at the list of potential navigators here, it includes, for instance, commercial fishing industry organizations. And it seems to me, they may be interested in just specializing in commercial fisher people and not covering a wider spectrum of the population. The benefits of allowing some more specialization among navigators is it could lead to more competent advice based on specialized expertise and knowledge of the types of people they're advising. It might attract more potential navigators if they don't have to cover a broader group of people. And the downsides are it could lead to a fragmented, hard-to-navigate system where the navigator system would have a bunch of wrong doors where people would be told they entered the wrong door and had to go out and knock on a different door. And so it sort of would eliminate the one-stop shopping concept that might be a good idea for navigators. Another option that occurs to me is dealing with the grant payments and trying to structure the grant payments to reward high performance or a high volume of assistance or successful outreach to potential enrollees or certain types of potential enrollees that the exchange might particularly want to reach. In other words, to have the grant payment structured to make the recipients accountable. And the pros of this or the benefits would be that it would provide beneficial incentives to navigators to kind of align their incentives with what the exchange wants them to do. The one downside is it could lead to complex grant negotiations and maybe limit participation by some navigators who with whom the exchange couldn't reach an agreement on the contract structuring how the grant payments would be made. Another option that occurs to me, and again this is all speculative because the federal bill doesn't really go into any of this, is that an exchange could decide to limit the number of navigators. And that seems like it could be reasonable because it would reduce the cost of supervision and training, especially of low-volume navigators who turn out not to actually end up enrolling very many people. One downside of that would be that the selection criteria would be controversial, and groups might contact their legislators to get the laws changed to require the exchange to operate the way they want it to operate and so on. So I think the bottom line on pros and cons of options are that we will need to wait for the federal regulations to see what things they rule out and what things they might rule in.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions for Ms. Kavanaugh, Mr. Chun, or Mr. Pender? Yes.
Madam Chair, Mr. Pender, is there anything, at this point, there's nothing in the regulation that precludes an enrollment and assistance into government programs also?
Madam Chair and Ms. Holmgren, no, it doesn't mention that one way or another. So it's not listed among the mandatory duties, but it doesn't say they can't. Doesn't say they can't do it.
Any other questions? Yes.
Madam Chairman, I want to kind of, on Ms. Holmgren's question, I want to remind us that we had $100 million identified as doing eligibility activities for our government programs. And we're talking about adding more components to the system. I mean, some of this is going to just continue to put layers on. And as we talk about a design, it's important that we create a system that makes sense. And we already have $100 million being spent on not exactly the same activities, but if we could design a system that could use the $100 million or lower the $100 million and not add more cost, I think we should think hard about having a system that does that and does this in some sort of orderly fashion instead of adding another layer of cost and another layer of navigators, eligibility checkers, enrollment folks, et cetera.
Well, I think the navigators are different from eligibility workers. Now, the navigators sometimes do help people do the enrollment activities that they need to do, but there still is somebody receiving that application who actually does determine if the application's been filled out properly. So they are different roles today.
Madam Chair, I'm just not That's sure where the $100 million, what that is representing.
Several meetings ago, we had a presentation that said, you know, we had 2,000 people in the state of Minnesota involved in the eligibility enrollment process for government programs. That's about $100 million a year we spend doing that, which I am appalled at, but not surprised. And so I would suggest we look at eligibility, enrollment, navigation, look at that as a process and say, how can we do that together and do that with a reasonable amount of resources using modern technology that most people can do.
It makes more sense to think of it more seamlessly when we get to the new system, because remember, the new system assumes everybody's in. The current system assumes you're not in unless you can prove you should be in. And so there's a lot of difference.
I totally agree. So we have an opportunity to not add another component, but to create a system. And if we're smart, we can do it with less resources. You're trying to balance a budget. Let's not leave money on the table that's unnecessary.
Sure. Other questions? Go ahead.
Mr. Chun, I have a question on the Minnesota Community Application Assistance Program. There's, as you said, three levels. The partners, the 120 partners that actually provide the application assistance, what's their, are those like libraries or vehicle registration places? Yeah, what makes up that, who are these organizations?
Madam Chair, the DHS website for this program contains a list of each of the organizations by county, but they tend to be things like the Salvation Army, some of the community clinics, Catholic Charities. So they tend to be sort of existing either healthcare providers or, you know, nonprofits working with low-income individuals. And of course, there are a whole range of other entities as well.
Madam, so actually this would be like the social workers, like hospitals and clinics, community health centers, where actually if they get them enrolled, then they're actually able then to get paid from the actual public program. So there's also a possible self-interest to get these people enrolled because they're coming to them for services because they're sick. And then they find they have no insurance, so they have an incentive now to try to get these people enrolled, the $25 they get. But the big picture could be that they're receiving reimbursement now from one of the public programs that they're getting enrolled in. Is that a fair statement? Or,
Madam Chair, I mean, I think obviously in some cases some of the persons who are going to be placed in a healthcare program, you know, would receive services from say, the healthcare provider, but the payment, you know, is sort of a one-time payment. That's not an ongoing payment.
Right.
So I think it differs a little bit from what was talked about for Utah and Massachusetts.
And I think, you know, one of the things that we found is over the years with the budget deficits, as we've cut Medicaid reimbursement, a lot of these organizations have told us they simply cannot afford to do this administrative task without getting reimbursed for it. And they were just actually turning people away. Other questions? Representative Thiessen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does this have to be a person who's talking to someone? I mean, could someone come in and set up a kiosk in a mall and someone could come and apply and provide all the information electronically? And then if that person is successful, that organization will get reimbursed?
Madam Chair, Representative Thiessen, I guess I'm not sure of the details of what DHS would consider eligible for reimbursement. The reimbursement or the agents that are signed up are organizations, and then the individual staff have to have training. But I think
ultimately, there has to be a way for the application to be submitted by the community organization to DHS with the, you know, the three-digit identification number. I mean, I don't think it rules out using some type of electronic methods, but I'm not sure if that, I don't know if that's the case now. I would assume not.
And is this all, Madam Chair, and this, all these are things that we can do in Minnesota, right, for the most part? We can decide all these issues?
I think, Madam Chair and Representative Thiessen, in Utah and Massachusetts, their connector and their exchange are very user-friendly. I mean, you know, if you hop onto the connector now on your computer and you're an individual, you can sign yourself up pretty easily. You know, and I would assume that they could have kiosks with the, you know, connecting you to the exchange, you know, and you could do it, you know, and small employers are doing it. I mean,
I think that the navigator function has been included in the legislation more from a perspective of people that might not be in the mainstream in terms of receiving services. So people that are language challenged, people that maybe they don't even necessarily in their culture understand the way our insurance system works, people that might have some kind of a disability that might create a barrier for them to be using the traditional means of accessing an exchange.
And Madam Chair, could we limit payment for the navigator to people? They have to actually certify that they need special assistance?
My understanding of the previous presentations are that your exchange has to have a navigator function within it. In addition, you may have a navigator function that goes beyond the staff that would be available through the exchange.
Right, okay.
So you could have some navigator functions that would specialize in reaching hard-to-reach populations.
And we wouldn't have to have them necessarily for other populations.
No, you could just have what's in the exchange already meet that responsibility, I think. Ms. Kavanagh, I was wondering about the money that's in the Massachusetts exchange that otherwise would have gone to a commission, but if there's not a broker involved, it goes to the exchange to help offset their administrative costs. Do you know if that covers their administrative costs, or do they have other other ways of generating revenue to cover other administrative costs?
Madam Chair, I believe that any product that's purchased, so if individuals buy through the exchange, there is going to be a percentage of that premium that also goes to the administration of the exchange as well. And I believe they are self-sustaining through those fees.
Maybe we could find out how much of it comes from this foregone broker commission.
Madam Chair, I could do that, but I would think very little since this is not, you know, the small employer use of the connector is very small. If you look at, you know, the numbers of who's in Commonwealth Choice, they've got 36,000 members, and most of those are non-group members. So they're not coming in.
They don't charge a broker fee for the individuals?
They don't charge a broker fee, but there's going to be a percentage that's part of that premium that's going to go to the administration of the exchange.
Right.
Yes.
Right. Other questions? Yes.
Just a couple of things. I hear a discussion of both the navigator role and enrollment assistance, and those could be kind of mushed into the same thing, but they might be considered as separate roles. And by way of explanation, I work for an organization that's been doing primarily enrollment assistance for the last 15 years, and we are one of the MNCA agencies. Some of the MNCA agencies are providers who have excellent access to patients, but an organization like ours, who represents another approach, we we have no vested interest, and the $25 we receive per successful enrollment represents only a piece. It probably costs us $100 to $150 per enrollment to find the people and then get them successfully enrolled. Just wanted to kind of clarify that. And I guess that I also wanted to mention that in reading about the Massachusetts model, Wisconsin, California, New York, they all talk about enrollment assistance roles that could be incorporated into an exchange. And they are really not looking at those kind of the top layer that can be enrolled on an online system or at a kiosk. I mean, those things can be effective. One of the states enrolled 60,000 people in 3 months using their online web. But what we're really talking about with enrollment assisters is those people who don't get in the first 3 months or the first 3 years because they don't understand the system. We have a couple hundred thousand in Minnesota right now who apparently are eligible but haven't gotten in. So just some thoughts.
Madam Chair, and I guess Ms. Kavanaugh had addressed the different exchanges. Looking at the Utah exchange and the fees that have set up there, is that similar to what the responsibilities of the navigator, where it's just getting them enrolled, but there doesn't seem to be is there continued assistance like an agent in our community does beyond just getting them enrolled, or is that do they just get them enrolled and then there's an 800 number for the...
Madam Chair and Ms. Coleman,
it
depends on what the employer wants out of that broker. The broker can service that account just like the broker does any other account outside of the exchange. When I talked to Utah, they also said that $37... commission could be split if, for example, the broker just wants to sign them up and provide that initial assistance, and then they want to use that center for any sort of questions, then they can split that amount. So some of it would go to the broker, and then some of it would go to the center. Now, I'm not quite sure how that works, but that was at least mentioned to me. So, you know, I think it really all depends.
Okay. And Madam Chair, just one follow-up to that then. So in the legislation for the federal reform, though, it really appears that the navigator role is a subcomponent of what a normal broker or agent would do, in that it's you get enrolled, but then you have an 800 number that you call in if you have claims questions or if you have some other questions. I'm just trying to get an idea of what is the scope of the expectation of the navigator versus what we have providers or brokers and agents do in our community today.
Madam Chair and Ms. Coleman, as I read the federal law and the navigators, the functions performed seem to all involve enrollment, with the possible exception of the one where the navigator can receive complaints or questions or comments and make referrals with them. And I mean, that could be either before enrollment or after enrollment, as I read it, but okay. Who knows.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A follow-up on the Utah exchange. Katie, is your understanding that is the fee of $37, the broker fee, is that only to small employers that use the exchange? Is that the same fee that if you're outside the exchange in Utah that an employer would pay?
Madam Chair and Ms. O'Connell, you know, I'm not sure about that.
The information that I have gotten when I asked that question of the people that run the Utah Exchange was that they made a political decision that every single enrollment would get a broker fee to a broker, whether there was a broker involved in enrolling that person into the exchange or not. And now they're kind of phasing it out, it sounds like.
And Madam Chair, the reason I'm asking is that I was on a conference call last week with Utah and Wisconsin, and the person from Utah said that there's been very little, that most small employers have dropped out of their exchange. And I wondered if this price of $37 had perhaps been part of the reason that small employers weren't using the exchange.
Madam Chair and Ms. O'Connell, I didn't hear that. I do believe it probably is different. For example, in Massachusetts, it is different. I mean, the commission is higher outside of the connector. And I think that's probably, and the people I talked to in Massachusetts said, I think the brokers probably tend to steer people outside of the connector because they're going to make more money. So I don't, I mean, okay. I can follow up on that and see if I can get some more information
too.
From my contacts in Utah to see what the difference is. So.
Other questions? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Pender, I know you said that there's not a lot in the federal law in terms of parameters. Is there any discussion of the duration that these navigator programs, have to have, or of the just amount of funding that would go into these grants, or is that all left up to the states to determine?
Madam Chair and Mr. Cryan, the bill doesn't really deal with that. It simply says that they have to have a navigator program. And I interpret that as having it up and running when the exchange is going to start. And it says the grants paid to the navigators have to come out of the exchange's operational funds. So basically, they have to get the money to pay for the grants one way or another, either by assessing it as a part of the premium paid or getting a separate legislative appropriation or whatever, but that's pretty much the limit of what it says on that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to follow up on that, it just would seem to me in general terms that we would hope that the user-friendliness of the exchange would increase over time as we learn through experience, and that this would be a really useful function for, making sure that people get coverage through the exchange, but more so earlier on than later on. And so just as a sort of general comment of goals with this, it would seem useful to think about how to set up the incentives for the navigator role and the way these grants work in a way that would at least make it possible for the programs to kind of shrink with time as they become less necessary.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you. Then before we go on to the next part of the agenda, is there someone here from DHS that could come and just talk a little bit about factors that you use in your risk adjustment system and other questions regarding how it works, if it's been evaluated, etc.
Madam Chair, members, we don't have anybody at this time, but we will prepare something and send it to you by tomorrow. I apologize for that.
All right, then we'll get that out to everyone. The drawback of this method of communicating, I might just add, however, means nobody gets to ask you questions. And that is definitely a drawback because the communication may not always be as clear to everyone as you think it is. Let's go on with our agenda then. And the next thing on the agenda is a presentation by Greg Vitillo. The Minnesota Association of Health Underwriters.
Madam Chair, members of this committee, my name is Greg DiTillo. I'm representing the 58,000 insurance agents that are currently licensed in the state of Minnesota. I have 15 minutes to show you how we could use the agent community to protect the exchange from adverse selection. I like to start off with a question, and the question is, why do insurance companies pay agents? Is it because agents need the money for their families? Is it because insurance agents, by law, must be paid by the insurance company? Or is it C, the companies need agents in order to stay in business? Yes, it's answer C. So now what I'm going to do is explain why the agents have been part of this delivery system for over 80 years. Agents are hired to do two things. One, insure the uninsured. When an agent wakes up in the morning, the first thing that comes to their mind is, who am I going to find to go insure? Second thing is, how do we keep people insured continuously? Now, there's currently two methods that we use in the private market. First, some buy insurance. That's an immediate need. You have two types of buyers, the ones that buy insurance, and then there's most are sold insurance. It's a voluntary decision. Now, let's talk about the individuals that buy insurance. These are the few individuals that will call a health insurance company or agent on their own. This is unusual. Our first question when we get a call is, do you have any health issues? And I'm sorry to say, most of the time they say, yes. I just got diagnosed with blood pressure, high blood pressure. I got just diagnosed with diabetes, or I just found out I had cancer. So we know immediately we do not have to create a need for insurance. They expect that their medical claims are going to happen in the very near future. It's immediate. People that buy insurance are hoping their premium will be less than their claims. That's why we're getting the call. And most often, we classify them as high-risk individuals. As soon as we get this call, now we become a navigator using MCHA. Why? Because we know that there's no reason to try to sell them on the idea of the importance of insurance. So now what we do is we explain the six different MCHA plans. We'll assist in the application process. And we may put our name on the bottom and receive $50 for being a navigator. I know quite a few agents don't even do it. They just do it because they want to help the individual. Now, these individuals will remain continuously insured because it's a great deal. For every dollar they pay, they're getting back $2.14. So trying to make sure these people stay insured, there's no need for it because they understand what a good deal is. Now, let's go to the 80 to 85% of the population that really is sold health insurance. These individuals usually don't call us. They don't call the insurance company. Why? Because they don't have any immediate medical need. Believe it or not, there's a lot of people out there that do not see a doctor every year or every other month or whatever. So you have a lot of healthy people that have no medical need. They believe their premiums will be more than their claims. And they're true. That is a true statement. These healthy individuals most likely will pay more than what they'll ever get back. Now, here's our role. We must attract healthy people to the pool. We must keep them insured over the long term, even the years they have no claims. The companies compensate us, but only when we sell coverage. We have to have a positive outcome. And we keep getting paid as long as a person's insured. And that confuses a lot of people going, well, why does an agent keep getting paid? Well, because here I could tell you what happened this morning. I open up the email, and I get an email from the insurance company saying, John Doe here did not pay their premium. So what do? We call John Doe and say, hey, John, what's going on? He goes, well, I thought I'm going to buy a new boat. Oh, okay. Well, you still got to pay your premiums. No, I don't think we really have to. I mean, we're healthy. Well, you know, John, that if you get sick, you're not only going to lose your boat, you're going to lose your house, you're going to lose everything. How about if I stop over and pick up the check? Okay. So healthy people, it's a continuous, ongoing sell. That's where the relationship is. Now, protecting the risk pool. The reason the insurance companies have us is because without agents selling to healthy individuals, the insurance company suffers adverse selection. Adverse selection is when more unhealthy people buy insurance than healthy people. Adverse selection creates higher insurance premiums, which eliminates healthy people from joining the risk pool. The higher the premium, the harder our job is. That's why we would love to see insurance premiums go down. Now, eventually, only individuals with high claims will still be enrolled in the risk pool. Adverse selection is a cancer that will kill any insurance company. Now, protection against adverse selection. Here's the example. We have to dilute the large claim individual with a small or no claim individuals. Example. You got an individual with a $25,000 claim. Their premium is $5,000. We have to find the other $20,000. That's why insurance companies hire us, is to go find four individuals that are willing to pay $5,000, and they get nothing back other than peace of mind. So here, an exchange must also have healthy people in the pool. Individuals with health problems will call a navigator to enroll. And that's what I was getting at with my question is, who's actually calling the navigator right now? Well, those are people that are probably sick. Now, the ACA creates two methods to get healthy people into the pool. Buying down premium with subsidies. Okay, we talked about having subsidies up to 400% of the federal poverty level. There's also a new mandate that everyone must buy insurance by enrolling. It's called an involuntary purchase. Now, how well has subsidies attracted good risk? Minnesota's largest population of uninsured are healthy individuals currently eligible for a public plan. Of Minnesota uninsured population, 61% are currently eligible for a subsidized public plan. Of those, 97% are healthy risk. Only 3% of the uninsured population rank their health status as poor. So this is the population that if we could get them into the exchange, that would lower the rates for everybody. But subsidies will draw definitely the people with the claims. But as this Department of Health study back in 2009, and we had to go back to 2004 because they stopped asking about their health status. Now, mandating insurance coverage is not a new idea. There's 47 states mandate auto liability insurance in the U.S. Now, CBO, Congressional Budget Office, December 2008, says there's still 14.6% that do not comply. They don't comply even with the threat of losing their driver's license, threat of losing your vehicle registration. Now, in Ramsey County here, you could spend 90 days in a workhouse if you do not have automobile insurance. That's a pretty strong mandate. Threat of up to a $1,000 fine, okay? But we still have 15% of the population that still ignores it and is willing to pay fines and actually go to jail. Now, what we're going to do here is we're going to do penalties for not owning insurance. First of all, let's look at the average annual cost. Auto insurance in the state of Minnesota is average for, this is liability insurance. Okay, you don't have to buy insurance on your car for collision, but liability you do because you could hurt somebody. Now, the auto insurance average annual cost for liability is $410. In the U.S., the average annual cost per person is $4,824. That's almost 12 times greater. So now you have imprisonment, yes, up to 90 days. The new law, there is nothing that could put you in jail if you don't buy the insurance under the mandate. What privileges do you lose? You lose the driver's license, and under the new ACA law, there's nothing that you lose that we know of. Fines, penalties, as we said, you get up to $1,000 per occurrence. This here is $95 in 2014. Now, that's 2% of the premium. So that's why you hear people saying that they will drop their insurance, pay the $95, because it costs 2% of what the average cost is. Now, it does go up to $695 in 2016, which is less than 15% still. Now, mandatory months to be insured. Under the automobile, you got to be insured to 12 months as long as you're driving a car. Here, you only have to be insured 9 months in order not to receive the penalty. Now, the average annual savings just from those 3 months is $1,206. So there's an incentive for people to be uninsured for 3 months out of the year because they could actually pay 3 years of their auto liability insurance by saving 3 months on their health insurance. Now, pre-existing conditions covered. Now, under automobile insurance, there is no what we call pre-existing accidents that are covered. Okay? Now, here, the reason that the car insurance doesn't have it is because people would drop their car insurance, wait until they have an accident, and then call up their insurance company and get insured, and now their pre-existing accident would be covered. We know that the insurance companies would not be able to stay in business. Now, under the medical insurance, however, it is yes. And this is the great debate right now on what's going to happen if people don't want to buy insurance until they get sick. So here, you have now what's called jumpers and dumpers, okay? And this is a new term that's actually come out of Massachusetts. With jumpers and dumpers, a jumper is a new term used when an uninsured person becomes ill or has an accident and jumps in to the insurance pool to have their claims paid for. So they jump in and then they dump it as an insured person that dumps their insurance by not paying their premium once they think they will no longer have the medical claims. I just got an email this morning. Boston Herald here shows that 24.2% of the people that were enrolled in the Massachusetts connector dropped their insurance within 12 months. Okay? Major problem. So, here, guarantee issue with no pre-existing condition exclusion makes it attractive for healthy people to become jumpers and dumpers. Now, persuading healthy people to join the risk pool, that's what we do. That's what we do for a living, is to convince people to buy insurance. Now, in order for the exchange risk pool to stay clean, you could try all these different risk adjustments and all that, but you need the healthy people to come to the pool. You need their money. Well, we only get paid when we're successful at doing that. So as a agent community, we are hoping that we are going to become part of the exchange because it's a win-win for everyone because we will bring the healthy people over with our skills that we have. Now, the legislature will decide if agents are able to sell inside the exchange. If agents are not included or are only navigators, the pool will grow and have adverse selection. Now, how to use agents to protect the exchange? It's real simple. You allow agents to do their job in the exchange. You compensate us fairly to retain them long term. Here's our resume. Minnesota agents are trusted by 2.25 million Minnesotans for their health insurance needs. So right now, that amount of individuals are using agents. Agents' results have been valued for over 75 years. Minnesota has one of the lowest uninsured rates in the United States. So that means we're getting the healthy people to join the pools. Minnesota is a low-cost insurance state as a result, because we're diluting the average cost down because we're out there bringing in the healthy risk. Now, here is our most recent reference, and this reference is actually from the federal government. This comes from the Congressional Research Service study from October 1st, 2010. That was, what, 3 weeks ago? What do they say? Health insurance-related complaints nationally. What they did is they did a study with all 50 states. In 2009, all the Department of Commerce sent all their complaints against insurance companies to this research study. Out of the 125,651 complaints, that's how many complaints the general public had against insurance companies in all 50 states, 125,000. What they did is they broke it down in 20 categories. Agents, quote, rank relatively low on the list of concerns that consumers have about their insurance coverage. In other words, 97% of complaints were not about agents, only 3%. So what that tells us that we're a professional group of individuals that's not getting the general public ticked off at us from getting them to sign up for expensive health insurance. Because if we were obnoxious to the general public, there'd be a lot more complaints that would be filed against us. Now, it also reflects how our agent support staff is, because this here, we're out delivering promises. And if I could just have this, this is my staff here. Okay, stand on up. Okay, these are the people. Okay, that are actually okay. They're the ones that make this happen. So when you look at one, I've got 10 employees. Okay, they do it. Thank you. They're the ones that make this happen. Without the agent, you're going to have a risk pool, and you're going to go, why isn't there healthy people joining up? Well, those are the navigators. They're getting the calls from the sick ones, but the healthy ones, somebody has to go out and bring them into the pool. Thank you. Questions?
So, Greg, do you know how many people each year in the state of Minnesota are imprisoned or lose their driver's license or are fined $1,000 for not having auto insurance?
No, I don't.
Hardly anybody. And that's the problem with comparing the auto insurance mandate to a health insurance mandate. They are not apples and apples. You know, the only people that enforce it are police officers who happen to catch somebody. And most of the time, they give people the benefit of the doubt, because most of the time, the people they stop do have auto insurance, and they might just not have their card in the car with them. So, you know, they'll give them a warning ticket. But the number of people that actually have these things happen to them when they actually don't even have insurance is relatively small compared to the people who don't have auto insurance.
So the 15% that don't buy it, they know there's no teeth in the law.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, that's total news. I have you know, I never saw a study, you know, stating how many times they do actually enforce the law.
Well, good luck getting into an accident with an uninsured motorist, I'll tell you that.
Thank you.
Green.
Yes.
Madam Chair, this question, I think of brokers. I'm primarily in the public, you know, system. And my organization is one of the Mincas. And we get $25 if we help somebody actually get an application approved. And so I kind of think of us on the public side, and I kind of think of brokers on the private side, kind of helping perhaps with the same function. And so I have kind of two questions. One is, you know, what would you get for an average health care insurance policy that you sell? You know,
well,
what is the compensation? Could you just even give me a range?
Yeah, no, no. The individual ranges, I'm much more familiar with the group side, and it's pretty much right at $19 per employee per month, okay, which comes out to be like $225 a year, $224, whatever that comes out being. Okay, and that there, we're independent, so we have to pay our own payroll tax. We have to pay for our own health insurance. We pay for all our benefits. And then you have a staff that basically supports you. So let's say we haven't had a pay raise for over, what, nine, 10 years now. It used to be where we got paid as a percentage. But what happened was insurance premiums go up. Well, we just automatically made more. Right? Well, here, that system was replaced 10 years ago, where it's a flat dollar amount no matter what plan you sell. So, you know, here, if there's an incentive to sell a higher premium so you make more money, that doesn't exist at all in the, at least in our market. There's other states that that is, but in Minnesota, not. Did I answer the question?
It seems that, yes, and it seems that we share the same issue of flat salaries for a long time. I can certainly relate to that. As we're going forward, though, you know, I think I would hope, and like my organization would hope, that in some ways we are replaced, because in some ways we are needed right now because of the complexity of our healthcare market, or both public and private. And I'm hoping that as we go forward and design the exchange, that, you know, we can all be working towards the simplification piece that will help, you know, truly make it easy for either public or private to access insurance.
Yes, simplification is definitely a good ingredient. However, when you have individuals that are healthy, you have to be very creative in how you get these people insured. So if you have a handful of products, it's very hard to sometimes bring in the healthy risk. The sick risk is very easy because they understand a good deal. For every dollar they pay, they're getting back $2 or $5 or whatever, okay? And they're all going to just jump right onto the exchange. However, the people that really say, hey, I don't need insurance, I'll pay the penalty, that's going to be that's the tough sell. And that's why in our profession they say that there's 10 people that get a license, and at the end of a year there's only one left, okay, because it is a very hard thing to convince people to pay $5,000 and not receive anything back.
Other questions? If not, thank you very much.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Mr. DeTille, I just had a quick question. If you could maybe just at a high level just talk about what, so in addition to enrolling individuals, what services do you provide to your customers?
Well, here, Penny there, she's the attack dog. If anybody has a problem with a claim, I guarantee you she will get the money from the insurance company, okay? Heather there, okay, all the group meeting renewals and whatever. I've got Jason over there. He does all the COBRA for all the terminated employees. We do all the COBRA administration for our clients, and we don't charge them an extra dollar. That's part of the $19.
Where's crew? But and there's Ailey. Stand up, Ailey. Ailey there, okay? He makes sure all the new hires, changes, and terms. He kind of manages part of the business that when there we have multi-language, we have Spanish, English, and Hmong to enroll people and answer their questions. But that's all part of the $19, fee. We don't charge anything extra. We do all the 5500s, the tax reporting for the clients. There's a list of things that really the employer really doesn't like doing a lot of things when it has to do with anything to do with insurance. So we're the go-between and with the plan design and but claims in administration is the big functions, and then trying to be creative with how do you set up a benefit plan where the employer is willing to pay all this money and make sure the employees are still covered in a satisfactory way. So there's a lot of pieces that go together.
Any other questions?
Yes, Madam Chair. And Greg, and sort of general comment and question about you raised.
Can you pull the mic over?
Your information actually does raise an interesting question and situation. Without the individual mandate, it does create the kind of scenario that you described, that there are going to be jumpers and dumpers. And I was wondering, because one would not expect Minnesota to be any different than Massachusetts with regard to that. And the teeth of the PPACA are not sufficient to change that. Does Minnesota have the option of putting more teeth into the individual mandate? Because if we don't have healthy insured, we've lost the battle. I mean, we will not be able to succeed. And I was just wondering whether the state, as it moves forward with the exchange, has the option of maybe making the penalty not, $900, $600, but being the cost of what would have been the insurance. In other words, they don't have to be insured, but their penalty is going to be what it would have cost them to be insured.
Do we refer that question to our staff? I'm not sure if the law is clear about that at this point, but we'll get that and we'll send it out to everybody. Yeah. The answer to that question.
That's a good question.
I would also just, however, point out that originally when Massachusetts set up their program, they required premiums of everybody at 150% of poverty or higher. Down to 100% of poverty. And they changed it later to those that are at 150 and above because, it was just really, people were struggling to pay this premium. And they found that once they made that administrative change, they had many fewer people dropping their coverage. So I think, to some extent, a person's willingness to keep coverage has something to do with affordability. Mm-hmm. And that's why we need to be paying attention to that piece of this equation as well, especially for lower-income people. I think at some point we should get some information about the number of people enrolled in Minnesota Care each year who don't file claims. Or don't file a claim other than a primary care visit, because it's pretty high. It's pretty high. And we don't have a mandate. They're not required to be in it. But there still are a lot of people in this state that worry if they don't have coverage and something happens to them, what are they going to do? We'll see if we can get that information. I just don't think it is entirely valid to assume that a large number of people are going to try not to have coverage, because there is so much at risk. It is the largest reason for bankruptcies being filed in the United States of America is due to an uncovered medical expense. Most people aren't willing to risk having to file bankruptcy in order to avoid purchasing coverage that, especially if it's affordable. Other questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Now we're going to have a presentation by the counties about the issues they see in the Medicaid eligibility processing under an exchange and how they view their role. Initially, at least, the exchange is not envisioning enrolling everybody that might be enrolled in Medicaid, but just doing eligibility for families and children who are not disabled. So why don't you talk to us about what your ideas and wishes would be in regard to an exchange in the enrollment process.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Dan Engstrom. I'm the Assistant County Administrator for Hennepin County Human Services and Public Health. And I'm here today to make some real brief remarks on the county's view of the Medicaid eligibility process under the exchange. Our county board has taken no official board positions about the exchange to date, but I know that our Hennepin County views the federal law as establishing an expectation that systems will enroll individuals with the minimal of possible burden and handle transitions from Medicaid and subsidized coverage seamlessly. The enrollment systems that we envision to be would be consumer-friendly. That would be that applicants are screened for all available programs and enrolled in the appropriate program with minimal collection of information and documentation from applicants. We also view that programs must be coordinated across all available health subsidy programs to enable seamless transitions between those programs. We know that the system must operate with a simplified, streamlined enrollment process, and it needs to foster administrative simplification using uniform income rules and forms, as well as paperless verification procedures. And we view that the states will need to be required to be technology-enabled. We need to operate enrollment portals and securely exchange information and utilize data to support eligibility determination. So we embrace these opportunities offered in the provisions of the Affordable Care Act. We'd like to see a robust exchange that can promote access to health care coverage and encourage maintenance of health coverage. Today we see all too many cases of churn in the system, people that become not eligible, not because they're not eligible, but simply because they don't follow through on the paperwork that's required. We recognize that our current health care programs are complex, and the complexity is time-consuming for our staff as well as the clients that we serve. Examples would be multiple income levels. Income is treated differently for almost every program. Sometimes certain income counts or partially count, sometimes for adoption assistance income counts, income from ineligible household members, and income from sponsors of immigrants, income from relatives. Self-employment income is also treated differently for the various programs. Household composition rules are very complex. They can be error-prone and inconsistent. And just in general, we know that the eligibility rules are simply, up to this point, have been too complex to automate. Like everyone else, we're waiting to see the federal rules that will provide further guidance to implement the federal law, but it appears that at least for families and children, we would see a single streamlined application that could be filed online, in person, by the mail, by phone. We would see possibly elimination of asset tests, expansion of presumptive eligibility. We would like to see paperless verifications and uniform income rules for all subsidized health programs. For counties, how we do our work we acknowledge will change, and we welcome the change to streamline administrative processes through reduced complexity and greater use of technology. I'm going to pass the presentation on to my colleague, Ruth Kruger from Dakota County.
Welcome.
Thank you. In addition to being the Employment and Economic Assistance Director for Dakota County, where all of our income maintenance programs are located, I'm the co-chair of MACSA, the County Welfare Directors Association, the legislative co-chair. So you have before you what MACSA has put out with bright red. We've been looking for simplification and technology. Well, it feels to me like all decade. And so we're really excited about what we hope is an opportunity. The current system isn't sustainable. The piece you see from Dakota County specifically has the growth rate of our medical and our food support programs. And the mountains below it, that's our unemployment rate growth. And so we're struggling. We have not added staff at the rate of the growth of the programs. And I was chatting with one of my staff members. I try to talk to them on a regular basis. And I promised her I would let you know today that she was telling me in the 10 years she's been with the county, her caseload's gone from 150 to 416. We've given more automation. We've done things that make that possible, but they're stressed to the max. So we're very welcoming of technology, of simplification. We have a platform that has specific ideas of things that we could do for simplification. One of the questions and things we're wondering is most of what you've been listening today is focused on how do you get people on? Not what happens after that. How much accountability are you going to want in a number of the folks that we handle at that low end under 400% of poverty? There is some income means tested. How often are you going to want that checked? We have a very mobile population. Even keeping up with them, making all the address changes isn't a simple operation. They move from county to county. So we're very interested in how we might be able to simplify that, make it sustainable. There's so many unanswered questions in that. But the current situation that we have with our GAMC population is certainly problematic. We're looking at whether there may be early enrollment. But I guess I've been in the business so long that 3 years, 2014, sounds pretty early to me. And I'm very pleased that the state is making moves right now to figure this out, because 3 years will go in the blink of an eye, as we know, and it's going to be very complicated. You asked for cost. You have two cost figures there. You have Dakota County's at the bottom of the chart that shows the growth, and then you have a separate handout for Anoka's. I think Anoka was actually able to separate out their eligibility. Ours is all of the administration. From the time we get the application till we either approve or deny it, and then ongoing, continuing to verify eligibility as it goes. We have a very hard time separating that out. It's also difficult for us because these people don't just have health care. Most of them are on food support. A number of them are on child care. Some of them actually get cash grant. So all of these things overlap. And many financial workers just simply do the whole function at one time. Whether that will continue to be the process for the population that is subsidized is one of the questions you'll have to answer. Many of the people we work with, well, you know, and I always think it's interesting because we talk about low-income people having a hard time figuring out their health care options. I can tell you that I've worked in a number of professional, not all of them public, and when the health care changes in open enrollment, no meetings are better attended than the open enrollment meetings in your organization. Because everybody struggles to figure out their health care. What does it mean? What's covered? What isn't covered? Somebody, whether it's a navigator, a broker, an eligibility worker, somebody needs to help people figure that out. Unless we get this whole healthcare system in this country much more simplified than I see on the horizon yet, but I'm always hopeful.
Can you, these numbers that you included here include elderly and disabled as well, I assume?
Yes, they do. All
is there any way to break that out? Because that's a different population for exchange purposes.
The state may be able. They do actually do some.
They struggle with that, too. But so is there's no way that you think you guys can break that out?
We might be able to do some of it. We actually have units that process family and those that do elderly and waiver. But you're talking 87 counties. How well we can give you a picture?
Just the snapshots of the two counties here. Whether those.
We will go back and see. We just got the request on Monday, so we did this very quickly. We'll go back and take a look and see if we can split it out any further.
That'd be helpful. Representative Laffa.
Well, and as you try and do that, I think if you can give us any information about efficiencies in the current system, because of those families that are potentially going into the exchange or will go into the exchange, as you mentioned, many of them are on food support. They might be getting child care assistance. They're getting child support collection assistance. And so there's some efficiencies right now where we kind of do the total package that will potentially be lost if the exchange is only able to gather information that's required to get into the health programs. And the other thing that I wasn't aware of until I'd seen this handout that we'd gotten here from the Kaiser Foundation was that that the public agencies are now also going to have a new responsibility that when they turn someone down for assistance, they have to not just do right now where they might say, well, you can check out the private market and here's some sliding fee providers. They're going to actually have to help them through the exchange process and getting into private coverage, which I don't think many public employees know anything much about the private sector. And how that transition will be made, but I was surprised to see that's a new responsibility.
Yep, Marie.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a question. I'm wondering if either of you have been following the technology developments in the other states, because I recently read that 27 states have a fairly well-developed online system, and out of those 27, 19 have integrated their healthcare systems, have more of an integrated system where they also include food and cash and child care. And I'm just wondering if you are following those developments.
Mr. Chair, Ms. O'Connell, you have to, I think, watch that carefully. I know we've gone out and we've looked at Badger Care. There's the Star system in Texas, and there's other systems that we've looked at. And we're looking for that system that does that complete job from not just enrollment and signing up, but actually the automated eligibility. And I think some of the latest systems have gone that far. There's a few states that actually have that algorithm that computes the eligibility, but a lot of these systems right now are information and enrollment systems, but that worker behind that is still looking at all the complexity of the rules and regulations and determining what that benefit level is and some of the detail behind it. So there is a lot of advancement in technology within the states, and I think we need to look at some of those that have made progress and see where we can learn from them.
And have you looked specifically at Badger, at the Access system in Wisconsin?
Yes.
One of the things, Chair, that we know is their systems aren't quite as complex as Minnesota's, that at the top of our list we always put simplification and then automation.
Mr. Chair, Ms. O'Connell, yeah, to elaborate, you know, we're all familiar with Health Match and I think the trials and tribulations there. And that really boiled down to the complexity. And when you ask the question, have you transferred property, and you look have a look-back period, it's very difficult to have a yes-no answer to that. There's always a yes, and then there's a lot of information behind that and a lot of complexity. And that was one of the difficulties of that of the health match system and getting that up and running was the complexity of the regulation behind just the basic question that was asked.
That's true. Representative Blossom.
Well, and I think if we look at what Wisconsin did, I think they did it the right direction, which was they totally simplified first, and then they tried to automate. And they did it in a way that actually they could cross-match files between different programs, and they got, I think it was an amazing number of thousands of people eligible just by cross-matching with data that they already had with women's infants, children, I mean, not reduced-price lunches, I mean, across all the different potential programs that people who would be eligible for program might be eligible for. So I think the burden's going to be on us to do the simplification work first before we hand off millions in computer money.
I think the bigger burden is finding the money to pay for all the new people coming on. That's why we've had problems with education, because we can't afford to have everybody on our public programs or have an odd way of paying for that. More than anything else, because everybody wants to simplify, but you got to find the money not to do the systems change, but actually to pay for the health care. But thank you for coming in today, and I think that wraps it up for us. See you in 2 weeks. We're here.